Hanging out up here. You think? Okay, how's that?
Yeah.
Yes, all right. Okay, we'll do this again. I'm sorry, we were just hanging out, chatting up here. Actually, that's a couple of minutes fast, according to my watch, but what do I know? If you didn't do... Okay. It works. If you didn't do the first exam analysis, but did the second one, your paper is here. If you did the first one and the second one, we haven't finished the second analyses yet. So they will be here Monday. Did I just promise that? Okay. I hope nobody heard me. Announcements? Questions? I'm feeling better, thank you. Not perfect, but I'm better. Still can't hear out of one ear. You don't ask me questions, I just get to do my thing, so push the button. Go ahead. All right. Thank you, I appreciate that. Got that up there? I just don't like for it to be untidy, family. Okay. In case I need to write on the board. We were talking about Sullivan, and that the basic tenets of his theory, that the number and variety of significant relationships that we engage in increases across the lifespan. And then when we finished, I was talking about the other useful part of his theory from my perspective, which is the connection between interpersonal needs, of which he says there are three, and the emotions that we feel when those needs are felt but not satisfied. Okay. And if you will recall, we had talked about security, which infants come into the world needing, and security in Sullivan's view is the sense that you have, the feeling that you have, that your significant relationships are fine. You're going to be treated okay. You're not threatened in them. There's no threat to the relationship. And when we have a significant relationship in which we feel that's not the case, then what we experience is the emotion of anxiety. And Sullivan's view was that whenever you feel anxious, there is at the bottom of that feeling somewhere a threat to a significant relationship. And that view of anxiety is different from the view of Freud and other people who saw the origins of anxiety differently. So you can argue about that. I don't think there is a preferred or correct, at least I'm not in a position to judge which is the correct view of anxiety, but it is a useful view of anxiety that Sullivan gives us, that we might want to think about the threat that is implicit whenever we feel anxious. And more importantly, we need to look at what we do when we feel anxious. And at that point, you can think about bringing Sullivan's view and Bowen's view together. Because Bowen is describing the anxiety that comes about, not only in relationships, but in life generally. and describing emotional maturity as the ability to deal with the anxiety and other strong emotions in a way that is constructive and not harmful to other people. So Sullivan and Bowen, although they start in different places, come together very nicely if you think about what we do with the anxiety that is aroused in significant relationships when they're threatened. Then I suggested or reported on behalf of Sullivan that as we move up toward the end of childhood, toward adolescence, we begin to feel a new interpersonal need, the second one, which he calls intimacy. And that's the desire for relationships that are psychologically close, in which we're known by the other person, we can communicate with the other person, we can share our fears and our anxieties with that person, and do that with the awareness that it's not always evident to other people how we feel or what we think. If we don't put it out there where they can hear it, they can't read our minds and know how we feel or how we think. And in Sullivan's view, intimacy comes about when two people who have that need come together and learn to deal with each other in a way that satisfies that need for interpersonal intimacy. That they know each other and they do that reciprocally and mutually. They are equals in the relationship and they work on the relationship collaboratively. Sullivan says that what happens in childhood is that we're playmates with other people and we like them and we may be friends, but as we move up toward adolescence, and this is described fairly well in the text, although it's not attributed to Sullivan, as we move up toward adolescence, what we think friendship is changes. And our friendships become more psychologically oriented. Our friendships become more revealing of ourselves. Because as we get up toward adolescence, there's more to reveal. We know that we have more feelings. We know that they're more complex. We see ourselves differently and other people differently than children do. So the way people describe their friends and other people they know becomes more complex, more abstract. We focus on personality. And what we expect in friendship begins to change to reflect what Sullivan is describing. The intimacy between two people who want to share their emotional lives, their feelings, and their thoughts, not just their activities and interests. Not that it excludes those, but it is added onto the repertoire of activities and interests that we share with friends. So Sullivan says what happens is that little kids have chums. Now they have buddies. And applies to both boys and girls. And they run in packs that are primarily same sex. In elementary school, play is pretty sex segregated. And friends tend to be chosen, not always, but tend to be chosen from the same sex. You share interests and you're more like each other. But what Sullivan says then happens as childhood is ending is that those buddies, those best friends, start spending a lot more time talking. They're becoming reflective and they start talking about what's going on in their lives and in their hearts and in their minds. And that can be, as I illustrated at the end with the Peanuts cartoon, that can provoke a lot of anxiety. Because what you're trying to do in relationships now is combine those two needs. So as we begin to look for friends, we want to develop the intimacy and do that in a way that keeps the security in the relationship. When sharing our thoughts and feelings raises too much anxiety, when the other person doesn't respond in a supportive and nurturing way and isn't reciprocal, then the security is threatened. One of the things that happens as kids get up toward adolescence is that they start seeking those intimate conversations with their friends, and sometimes they're out of sync. So you'll have two friends, and they've gotten along fine for years, and one of them begins to feel this need for intimacy and becomes reflective earlier than the other and starts raising ideas and thoughts and feelings and wanting to talk about those with the peer who is still not yet experiencing that need. So you may have had the experience either one side or the other. Maybe you had a friend who wanted to talk about feelings and you thought this was really, really weird. You know? What do you mean? Let's go play baseball. You know? I don't want to just sit here and talk. You know, what do you mean, sit in your room and talk? You know, get out your baseball cards. Let's do some trading. But I don't want to talk about what I think because I don't have a clue that I think yet. And that's the response of the person who doesn't yet feel that need for intimacy. And there are periods of time for many of us at the end of childhood in which our friends are out of sync with us. And people who are not equals and not mutually interested in creating an intimate relationship drift apart. And the ones who are immature say, well, he's gotten really weird. You know, I don't understand him. And the one who's feeling the need for intimacy and is working on it with a non-responsive buddy is saying, well, you know, he's, I don't know, there's something weird with me. That's what we usually say when we're the more mature one. There's something weird with me and we don't get along anymore. The interesting thing is that as both of them get to the point eventually of feeling that need, they may come back together in the friendship. And so you see friends who break up and they stop spending time with each other. Their parents will say, well, you know, why don't you spend time with Bobby anymore? You used to like to spend time with her. Sharon says, I don't know. Just, we don't get along. And then 2 or 3 years later, they discover that they're both interested in having an intimate friendship and they reunite and they're back together. Sometimes that happens after a long period of time. One of my examples from last year was an interesting one where a student in this course was listening to Sullivan. She came up afterward and said, that's what happened to me. I had a best friend in grade school and we got up to 5th or 6th grade and I don't know what happened, but it didn't work anymore. And when we explored that a little bit, she realized that her friend had hit the need for intimacy earlier than she did. And she thought her friend was going off the deep end, kind of weird. And so they stopped hanging out entirely until the summer after they graduated from high school. And they ended up working in the same place and discovered that, hey, they were in the same place psychologically. And they recreated the friendship. And her point was that it had happened to her, so maybe that makes Sullivan useful. Yes. And the fact that they had been friends all through grade school provided them a nice base for the renewed friendship, which had started out as they were talking about their experiences together in 2nd, 3rd, and 4th grade and things they had done together. And that gave them the shared history that let them discover their mutual interest in continuing the friendship, but on a completely different level. It is not easy to develop an intimate relationship when you're new at it. So it's part and parcel, in Sullivan's view, it's part of the process of becoming an adolescent, becoming a sophisticated thinker, learning to deal with your emotions, learning to understand relationships, and there is great potential for anxiety, and there's great turmoil in the early years of adolescence as people make overtures to other people for intimate communication. Those get over-responded to or not responded to. part of what an intimate relationship is based on is trust. If you're going to tell somebody how you really feel, as Lucy and Charlie Brown illustrated on Monday, that you need to be able to trust that the other person isn't going to tell everybody else about what you really think and what you feel. It's hard to not be anxious if you don't know whether what you're saying is going to get reported to everybody else. So one of the things kids learn early in friendship is to be able to promise confidence, promise fidelity. And then, of course, you know what junior high school was like. Yeah. Right? Some of you had the experience of having your best kept secret that you shared only with one other person who was sworn, you know, cross her heart and hope to die and all of those things. And then you found out that she not only blabbed, but she distorted it, and now you're getting criticism or flack or ostracism from people who used to be your friends and aren't anymore because you have this false friend who's betrayed you. Betrayed the intimacy of the relationship. And that betrayal is very hurtful. So one of the things that kids learn as they go through middle school and early high school is how to be a friend. Now Sullivan says that what happens at the beginning is that we're likely to create our intimate relationships, and I'll turn the lights on in a minute, but so you can read this. But what it says is homophilic, from the Greek meaning same, love or relationship. So Sullivan says that kids start off with a best friend, typically but not always, who's the same gender, because they're easier to be intimate with. And then one of the challenges of adolescence is to learn to be an intimate friend of somebody who of the other gender, or another gender. So somebody who's not like you, so a heterophilic relationship. And he says that's more difficult for most of us. It's easier if you have had older siblings of the other gender, because you get to hang out with them and maybe know them a little bit better. But if you don't have the experience of friendship with people who are of the other sex, then it's harder to create that intimacy. But eventually most of us want to have friends of the other gender, and ideally where you will end up is being able to have friends of both sexes, or all three sexes, or however many there are. You accept the diversity, and you can have friends who are different from you in many ways, not just gender. But eventually you're going to build that repertoire of friendship so that you have significant relationships, intimate relationships with people who are quite different from you. You know, people of other races, people of other backgrounds, ethnicities, religion. But each time you move into a new kind of intimate relationship with a new kind of person, there's likely to be some anxiety about that. And then you overcome that anxiety and expand your repertoire. Okay, the third need, sexual gratification. And this is experienced as an interpersonal need when you want to achieve sexual gratification with another person. Okay, so this is a mid to late adolescence phenomenon, and comes about because of puberty. Now, sexual gratification, self-gratification, does not have to be interpersonal. So all the kids who masturbate and get gratified that way, that's not an interpersonal experience. But it very quickly, for many people, becomes an interpersonal experience because you begin to fantasize about other people. So you fantasize having the intimacy with somebody and the sexual gratification. What Sullivan says is that then we've figured out intimacy, maybe, or we're in the middle of that. And then puberty hits us, and we begin to want to have relationships that are not just interpersonally intimate, but that are also sexual. And in our friendships and in our dating relationships, we may begin to explore sexual gratification as an activity within the relationship. And that also takes time and energy to develop. And the problem with it is that, like intimacy, it can create anxiety. Sexual experience, sexuality, can be very anxiety-producing. So if you begin to get sexual in a relationship that is intimate and secure, you have a new round of anxiety about that, about the sexuality. You're expanding the relationship to include the physical dimension as well as the psychological. And the anxiety that arouses, didn't choose that word carefully, the anxiety that arises because of that exploration can also interfere with the relationship. Eventually, Sullivan says, what you're looking for in adulthood is a relationship, at least one, that satisfies all three of the interpersonal needs. So you're looking for a relationship that is secure and intimate and sexually gratifying for both people. You can have other relationships that are intimate and secure, and friendships, but most of us only have enough time and energy to have one relationship that satisfies all three needs over the course of time. We may have them serially, we may have more than one, but trying to have more than one at the same time is difficult, in part because most of us have a pretty strong, how do I want to put it, possessive streak of wanting our partners to be intimate with us and sexual only with us over the long term. And sexual experience with other people interferes with the intimacy and the trust for most of us, not all of us, but for most of us. And if our partner is engaging in sexual behavior with other people, it may decrease the feeling of security, increase the anxiety, and eventually drive us apart. The evidence is that there are many people who try to have, in adulthood, who try to have more than one sexual relationship and make it intimate, but that's a very small number of people who actually maintain that lifestyle with full intimacy with both partners. That doesn't mean cheating on your partner and not telling. It means being able to share everything that you do, including your other sexual relationship, with your partner. And so that you can talk about how you feel about that relationship and how the other person feels about that, and have a trusting, intimate relationship while one or both of you are having a sexual relationship with other people. It's very, very difficult to do that. Okay, a couple of other details. Sullivan argues that in human relationships, in human development, these three needs not only appear in that order, but they are hierarchically important. Security is the most important. If you can't have a relationship that is not filled with anxiety or recurring anxiety, then you're in pretty bad shape. If you can have a relationship that is secure, then you can have the intimacy, and then you're in much better shape. But it's difficult to have the intimacy if there's a lot of anxiety. And sexual gratification, he says, is the least important. And many of our relationships are secure and intimate and not sexual. You know, in adulthood, many of us have friends. In adolescence, many of us have friends that we're close to, but they're not sexual relationships. Even after we commit to a sexual relationship with somebody with whom we're intimate and have the security, sexuality is one of the major sources of anxiety. And that's more likely if you don't have intimacy in the relationship. It's not necessary to have an intimate relationship to get married, to bear children, to have sex. You can do that. What's difficult is to maintain that relationship over a long period of time without intimacy. And I don't recommend maintaining a relationship for a long time which is constantly anxious. And why would you want to do that? People do, but why you would want to do that, I'm not sure. But the intimacy is important to maintain this sexual relationship at a mutually gratifying level over the long haul. You can do it for a while, but eventually, without the intimacy, the loneliness pops up. Remember being lonely in a crowd of people because you don't have an intimate friendship with anybody. Nobody knows who you are. Nobody particularly cares about you. So you feel lonely even though you're in the crowd of people. Imagine being in a sexual relationship, in a marriage perhaps, in a committed relationship in which your partner doesn't know who you are. So there's no intimacy. Your partner doesn't accept you as you are. There's no equality. You don't have the respect that intimate friends need. The most common comment from people who are divorcing is that within the relationship, within the sexual relationship, they don't feel loved, they don't feel accepted, they feel lonely. And I think that supports Sullivan's notion that the intimacy is important for maintaining a sexually gratifying relationship over time. Let me stop there. One more detail. For Sullivan, the difficulties that we experience in adolescence and in youth, the early part of adulthood, difficulties often come down to trying to find and create and maintain a relationship that's intimate and secure, and putting sexuality within that relationship. And one of the major reasons that adolescence is difficult in our society is that people are trying to meet both of those needs, and we don't do a very good job of helping them understand that they are different needs. And this is why I like Sullivan's work so much, because he reminds us, he makes it central to our understanding, particularly of adolescence, that intimacy and sexuality are different needs, and they're satisfied in different ways. One is psychological and communicative and emotional, and the other is perhaps really good sensuality and a good physical sense, and intimacy supports the sexuality. But they're not the same. And we don't do a particularly good job of helping people understand how to be intimate partners. We don't do a very good job of giving people the expectation that they will be intimate, they will develop those skills, and that's not easy. And then after they get that intimacy in a relationship where it's fairly secure, then maybe that relationship can become sexually gratifying to both people over the long run. there's a stereotype that is fairly old and still out there, which is that women know what intimacy is and they understand its importance in relationships. And some men, I'm not going to characterize all of us, but some men don't know much about intimacy. They haven't experienced it, they don't practice it, and their assumption is that they can have a good relationship if the sex is good, and they're jumping over the intimacy part, which is much harder and much more anxiety-producing than the sexuality part may be for us. Okay, let me stop there. I could illustrate, but let me see if there are questions about how his three needs and their emotions fit together. Yes? I'm sorry, there's no hope of Maya hearing you from down there. Yeah. Does loneliness? Yes. Well, in different ways. In different ways. Yeah. Anxiety will keep you from having a sexual response, period. Okay. But take a guy who's really anxious, he's not going to get it up. He's going to ejaculate prematurely. He's going to embarrass himself. No. And that's the simple reality. If you're in an unfamiliar and anxiety-producing situation, you're just not going to have good sex, period. And that's the physiological response being blocked by the emotion. You're just not there. So men aren't going to have a satisfying relationship or experience sexually if they're anxious. Women aren't going to reach orgasm if they're anxious. If you're afraid of your partner, it's impossible to have a good sexual experience. If you're unsure of your partner, if you can't communicate with your partner, if you haven't talked about what it is you're about to do or why you're doing it or how you feel about it, it's just not possible to have any more than the nuts and bolts, let's match our plumbing kind of sexual experience. But that doesn't last very long. And some of you have the experience of what do we call it now? Hooking up. We used to call it one night stands. I understand now that it's not a stand, it's a lay. So it's a one night lay. And what you hope is that after you've had the sexual experience, what you hope is that the person will not be there in the morning. And ideally, you will never see her or him again. Because it's just too embarrassing to think about it. The second question was, does lack of intimacy affect the sexuality, I think? No. The second question was, well, lack of intimacy is the loneliness. Okay, so if you feel the need for intimacy and you're not getting that, so you're feeling lonely and you're in a sexual relationship, it will eventually interfere. It interferes with communication because you're not talking about the sexuality if you're not in an intimate relationship. So it interferes with making the sexuality mutually gratifying. And it eventually, feeling lonely makes you not want to be with that partner. Initially, it may drive people into sexual relationships. So one of the issues for us, again, is the confusion of what it is we want. What's the need? If I am feeling lonely and I don't have a relationship, then one of the things I may do, because I want human contact of any sort, is I may jump into a sexual relationship, not because I'm horny or lustful, but because I'm lonely. And that may satisfy me till morning, when I realize that I don't have anybody to talk to, or this person I just spent the night with doesn't share any interest, doesn't know who I am, and doesn't remember what we did the night before and never calls me again. Now, so the lack of intimacy in a connection with another person will eventually destroy the sexuality. You just don't want it. It is possible. It is possible when one, particularly when one is young, to have mutually gratifying sexual experiences over a relatively long time with people that you're not intimate with. But it's not the basis for a relationship. It's not the basis for a commitment. So if we're living with somebody, if we're committed to that person, the understanding is that we will develop the intimacy. That's the expectation. And as I said, people get married without that intimacy, but eventually it wears on them that it's not there. And that the other person doesn't have a clue about what intimacy is and isn't interested in developing it. Several years ago, I had a student in this course who described the experience of having for several years an active sexual life that was quite gratifying in Burlington. Unfortunately, she was very attractive, but she was doing this when I wasn't single, and I didn't know it, so I didn't find out about it until after I was no longer available. If I'd known she was available, now, okay, can't go there. And I had been single, she was sort of everybody's fantasy. And she described it as a very active process of finding people to have really good athletic sex with. And having done that from the time she arrived at UVM until she was in her mid-20s, 27 or so. And she even had a name for it. I love it. It's describing sexuality that is a sport. It's not about relationship. And if you're a varsity sport fucker, you have learned to identify other people who are on the same team. They're in the same sport. And you have learned the rules, and you've learned to communicate within that very narrow aspect of your life. It's a very narrow aspect of your life. And you've learned to do that in a way that keeps everybody's anxiety very low, because there are rules. Rules about honesty, rules about safety, rules about communication about the sexuality. And under those conditions, where everybody is mutually committed to a good sexual experience, as they define it, you can have satisfying sexual experiences over a period of time with different partners and do that just fine. And so I asked her what happened. And she said she got up to be 27, 28. So what's this about? What's my life about? Where am I going to find the partner? And she realized that the partner wasn't among the other sport efforts. No, that just, I occasionally remember that this is going on the web. And sorry. I'll go back and edit that out. I think I can edit it, can I? Anyway. It's not my phrase, I'm just reporting it. So you get to that situation where you want the intimacy. And that happened for her. It took 7 or 8 years, or 9, but she got to the point where she wanted something else. And what she wanted was intimacy and commitment, and she realized that it wasn't going to happen as long as she stayed on the varsity. It's not going to happen. Because none of the people she met there were interested in intimacy. They became buddies to engage in a very narrow range of behaviors with. And it's fun. And if you want a parallel, I know people who don't like each other who've been playing tennis together for years and years and years. I know people who play bridge two or three times a week with people they're not intimate with. You know, they know each other, and so, you know, they just happen to have the same schedule. I know people who play flute who look for people to play duets with or trios. So they find a cello or a piano or a harpsichord and they share music and they make beautiful music together. But it's not an intimate relationship. And it's not a committed relationship, and it's not the relationship into which you're probably going to put your commitment for the future. And I see that, the sexual experience, as quite parallel to that. It doesn't seem to, I think it, well, you tell me, it seems to me to be the same, whether it's sex or tennis or bridge or music. It's all in the same category. And none of it is relational and commitment for the future. So it's not that you can't do it. Eventually, people stop wanting to do it. Most people, I guess. I haven't done surveys on that. But I don't know people who do that very long, or there are people who sort of forget to have partners and children when they get up to be 40 or so. They're the ones who wear the t-shirt, "Oh my God, I had a lot of fun, but I forgot to have children." Or now I'm all alone. And they change their style. I think you got the point, right? Okay. Other questions about Sullivan and how you might apply him? Yeah. Is there an emotion on that chart? Some of you have already looked on the website, so you know what it is. Sullivan, in fact, didn't. So Shelton did. You know, sometimes you've got to elaborate. But what is the emotion? You don't have to read very far into Sullivan to put lust in that space too, so I would accept either one. Okay. But it's horniness or lust that drives us to seek sexual gratification. And if you don't experience sexual gratification, then you either get horny or you get numb or something. Okay. Other questions? Okay, let me add then a few kind of closing comments about Sullivan. One is from the realm of counseling and therapy and marriage counseling and even sexual therapy. Sullivan is very useful because what you find is that if people have an intimate relationship, then sexuality comes relatively easily, as long as they are physically compatible and interested. Okay. And that's not guaranteed. And it certainly is not necessary within an intimate relationship, even within a marriage. People get married and make lifelong commitments to each other when they actually don't like each other's smell or taste or the way they move or how they feel. You shouldn't do that, but you know, people do that. In sexual therapy and in counseling, what typically happens when people are having sexual difficulties in the relationship is that when you examine the relationship, you discover that the intimacy is either has never been there or it's faded. people have gotten too busy, they ignore each other, they just don't communicate effectively, and they're not supportive of each other emotionally. And if they're not intimate, it's very difficult to maintain the sexual relationship. Often what happens is that the intimacy in a relationship becomes one-sided, and people discover that they married somebody who actually has never been intimate, and it's possible to grow up into adulthood without having the skills of intimacy, not knowing how to do that, and to be married and not learn. You have to be pretty dense, but you can get there. You have to be pretty anxious about intimacy, but many people are pretty anxious about intimacy. And they have partners who make them anxious sometimes about intimacy. Now, if you tell somebody how you feel and the person says you shouldn't feel that way, duh, there went the intimacy. Yeah. Out the door. You tell somebody they shouldn't feel the way they do, the intimate response to this is how I feel is, help me understand that. Let me understand that. How do you deal with your anxiety? You know, how do you deal with your sadness or whatever it is? It's not, you shouldn't feel that way. Or that's stupid. Those are non-intimate responses. So you can teach the skills of intimacy if people haven't learned them. You can teach a couple to communicate in a way that is intimate. It may be a major set of steps for them to take, but they can get there. And that's what couples counseling is often about. It's about marriage therapy. Marital therapy is often about. I think I've said everything I need to say. Not for the day, just about Sullivan. Okay. What I want to talk about briefly, I want to go back to the beginning in Sullivan and talk about the parent-child relationship in infancy and refer you to the material in the text on attachment. I want to talk about what's happening in relationships in which we do become attached to or fond of other people. Where does that start? How do you get to be, and this is my bridge, how do you get to be an adult who doesn't know how to be intimate, you know, wants to be with other people, is actually quite fond of somebody, but not know how to be intimate? Where does the attachment itself start? And the text refers to John Bowlby's work, the late John Bowlby, who was a psychiatrist in England. Bowlby began asking the question about 60 years ago now, how is it that babies become attached to their caregivers? Why do they care about being with other people? And his very easy answer was that because we're human and because we're animals, we're mammals, who are very social. And being connected to other people, particularly our caregivers, is crucial to our survival. So infants gradually develop attachments with their significant others, with their caregivers. What he suggested is that we have evidence at the beginning, literally at birth, that infants are social and they're interested in other people and they're responsive to human beings without being specifically attached to them. So we have an indiscriminate phase, indiscriminate sociability. You can take the three-month-old and pass the kid around the room and the kid will gurgle and smile for everybody and mold. Doesn't matter as long as the people are treating the infant in a reasonable way. And then we see, a little later typically, but we begin to see the increasing preference for familiar people. And that actually starts earlier as kids are able to discriminate mother and eventually father from everybody else. And that starts very early. It's a discrimination learning task. How do I distinguish the people who are most familiar, most often with me, from everybody else? I watched a 15-month-old yesterday discover me. And this is a child who didn't know me, and we were in an unusual place, a place where she often is, but I've never been in her presence. And I was making noise and came around the corner and was face to face with her. And I figured she was going to freak out. And I give her a lot of credit. She held it together. She didn't freak out. But she was obviously very, very anxious. She clearly knew that I was not somebody familiar. And she knew that she didn't know anything about me or my intentions. So she displayed what we call stranger anxiety, sunk back into her caregiver's arms and held on for dear life, and was obviously going to take a fair amount of time. I didn't stay long enough for her to get to that point. But it would take her probably several days of periodic interaction with me to begin to be relaxed when I'm around. It would take a great deal more than that for her to become interested and attached with me, and that'll never happen. Okay? What we see as kids get up towards 7 or 8 months is that they are clearly specifically attached to specific caregivers, not just one, but 2, 3, maybe 4. But people who are regularly in their lives, whom they've learned to interact with and have transactions with on a regular basis. Are there things that parents do that encourage the development of specific attachments? By golly. Next overhead. Thank you. Now let's look at first what the kid does. Okay. We've talked about these. The kids are social and they attract the attention of more mature members of the species with postural adjustments and molding and all of those sorts of things. And these are common among mammal species. And particularly among primate species, they all develop specific attachments in pretty much the same way. What is it that adults do? Well, one way to think about it is to look at the behaviors in which adults differ and see which ones of those are likely to lead to a specific attachment with a child. And these are the typical list. Parents may or may not be sensitive in recognizing and identifying the kid's needs. The more sensitive you are to their needs, and the more easily you recognize them, and the more specifically you respond to them in helpful and comforting ways, the more likely it is the child is going to become attached to you. If you're the caregiver who sort of ignores the kid and doesn't respond to her overtures and does the wrong thing, you know, the kid's cold so you change her diaper, she's hungry so you wrap her up, you know, you're not making it. The transactions are not helping the child become more comfortable with you. And you're getting a reputation with the child as somebody who doesn't have a clue. The kid is likely to not become closely attached to you. You're not a trustworthy person. You're not the kind of person this kid can depend on. The appropriateness of the response. The timeliness of the response. Caregivers need to respond in a timely fashion to infants. You know, the longer they cry, the less likely they are to be comfortably attached with you. You need to be consistent. And this is probably the most important one and the bottom line, which is that you need to be interested in the child for the child's sake, not because the child has needs. I mean, that is a need. It's a very strong need. That you have interactions with the child that are interesting to the child, that become entertaining, that become the basis for cognitive development and interpersonal activity. So it's not just the caretaking stuff, the nuts and bolts of taking care of the baby. It's also the relational stuff. And relational stuff means that we respond and initiate interaction with a person when they're not asking for it in any direct way, when they don't need something. Okay? So the baby needs to have interaction with the caregiver that is just enjoyable. It's just there. It's not changing a diaper. It can happen while you're changing a diaper, but it also needs to happen at times when the baby doesn't need the diaper changed, because you like the baby. Okay. How do we know that kids are becoming attached? They show a clear preference for the familiar adults, and that begins about 7 or 8 months. They don't like it when you leave. They protest, separation protest. They're happy when you come back. And I'm going to add to the list one, which is the stranger anxiety, which is that if an unfamiliar adult is around, then you're not going to go to that person. You're not going to approach that person directly. And then finally, the presence of the person with whom you are securely attached provides a secure base for you to explore. And that brings us back to Sullivan. If you are in a situation where you are with somebody that you trust, who has demonstrated that he or she can take care of you and respond to your needs and knows what you need and what you want, and you're a little kid, and this is a caregiver who's doing this, then the anxiety that you might feel in any situation is dissipated. You're feeling secure. And what do you do when you feel secure? If you're a little kid and you're curious, you explore. You explore. So cognitive development and exploration of new relationships, exploration of motor skills, happens more readily when you're in the presence of somebody that you trust to protect you, to tell you when you've gone far enough, to catch you when you slip, to keep something bad from happening to you. That's the advantage of having somebody that you're securely attached to. You've built up that trust. You've built up a transaction with each other that allows you to go beyond that relationship to explore new things. And kids who are not attached with other people have to figure out how to do their exploration and take care of their own anxiety. They often become very good explorers, but they learn to depend only on themselves. It may be difficult for them to move into new situations and explore new topics, new ideas, new situations, because they don't have somebody there who can support them in doing that. But they may do it. Okay. A number of years ago, and the text describes... Oh, I'm sorry. Let me add one more piece. What are the consequences of being attached? Yeah. Exploration, for one, but proximity seeking. If you're specifically attached to somebody and securely, you want to be close to that person, so you seek them out. You attempt to engage them in transactions with you. Most of us are less likely to engage strangers in conversation than we are somebody that we know. Right? You sit near somebody in class, but you don't know them all semester, and you never initiate a conversation with them. Somebody you know well and like comes in, the conversation starts up immediately. You invite your good friends to dinner, not strangers, typically. Okay. We modify our behavior. We change to promote and prolong the desired transactions. Remember in Sullivan, the anxiety that parents can create helps socialize us. We want to avoid that anxiety. So we change our behavior so they will continue to like us, and this is an extension of that. We modify our behavior, we learn how to behave, and we do it so that our parents won't put us in timeout, so that they won't threaten to send us back where we came from. But we want to maintain those transactions. Separation protest, I mentioned, and grief. We don't grieve very long over a loss of something that we're not attached to. But somebody that we're attached to is a significant loss. So attachments lead to grief if those attachments, the people that we're attached to, are lost to us. They go away, they move, we no longer see that caregiver, we experience grief. And the longer the attachment has existed and the closer we are to the person, the more grief we feel and the longer we feel it. Okay. In the text, you'll find a description of Ainsworth's work on attachment, in which she looked at what mothers did with kids and how the kids behaved in a really weird situation. And in that research, which you can review in the text, it's pretty clear there, so I don't think I need to dwell on it. What she comes up with is that kids who are with their, particularly mothers, will display several different types of attachment. And one of those we call secure. When parents do all of those right things, they encourage our secure attachment with them. If we can't really depend on the parent, and the parent isn't timely or consistent, we may become anxiously attached. So we're not sure that we can trust the parent, but we need the parent, we want the parent, so we become anxiously attached and clingy, and sometimes whiny. And kids in the second year who are anxiously attached with their parents have greater separation anxiety, have greater stranger anxiety, and it's more difficult for them to explore even in the presence of the mother. And Ainsworth's research was primarily with mothers. So the nature of the attachment that the child is forming with the caregiver is important. The third kind that she describes is kind of rejecting, hostile attachment. And that's the kind that says, okay, you're my mother, but I don't like you particularly because you aren't very good at it. And so I'm going to tolerate your company when you're around and use you as I need you and be comforted by you, that's okay, but because I can't really trust you to be consistent, it's not going to bother me if you take off. So in the strange situation that Ainsworth used, She brought kids into a lab with their mothers, and they played, and she observed what they did. And then a stranger came in, and she observed what the kids did. And then the mother left, leaving the kid with the stranger. She watched what they did, and then she watched what happened when the mother came back. And what you find with securely attached kids is that they're okay with the stranger as long as mother's there. And then when the mother leaves, they're going to be a little anxious about being left with the stranger. And they're going to be wary. And then they're going to be happy when mother comes back and want to show her what they've been doing. And with mother there, they can engage in comfortable interactions with the stranger. With mother there. The anxiously attached kids don't like it when the stranger comes in, and they don't engage with the stranger. They're the kids who bury in mother's neck and hang on and hide behind mom. And when mom leaves, the kids freak out. Okay. They're the ones who cry when you leave them with a strange babysitter. Okay. And they cry for a long time. And then when mother comes back, they're glom onto to mom, and they're the Velcro kids. And in the presence of that, in the situation where the kid has the anxious attachment, what you see is that the kid never actually engages with strangers. He's not comfortable engaging with the stranger. The mother doesn't provide enough of a secure base for the kid to do that. The hostile or rejectingly attached kid who really has decided that mom just doesn't do it, that kid will come into the situation and play separate from mom. And then when the stranger comes in, the kid is just as likely to go to the stranger as to mom, okay, which may indicate a lot of confidence. And then when mom leaves, kid's okay. If the kid gets fussy, the stranger is just as good at comforting the kid as mom was, the stranger. And when mom comes back, the kid may ignore mom or kick her. As you left me in this situation with the stranger, and I didn't know where you were going, so thanks. Okay. So some kids resist closeness because the parents presumably have not been consistent and not been effective in their nurturing roles. Some kids are anxious about the attachment because the parents have been inconsistent and helped them develop clinginess. And some kids are confident and securely attached, and they want to be with the parent who enjoys being with them, and they can use that as the basis for further development. Now, the question that intrigues me is, what do you do with the attachments that you form, particularly if you're an anxiously attached person, or if you're resistant to attachments? From a constructivist point of view, what I assume is that the kid is developing a set of expectations about relationships, and that the parents, the caregivers, are creating in the child an expectation that relationships are going to be secure, and people will treat you well and treat you nicely, and you develop the skills to do that yourself. Or you're developing an expectation that people will be inconsistent and you can't really depend on them or trust them, so you're going to be anxious. Or the parents are creating an expectation that people shouldn't be trusted, and therefore I'm going to do without attachments. I'm not going to relate to other people particularly well. What happens over time? The text, again, describes some of the changes that happen as we grow up. We think about coming out of infancy as an anxiously attached person. How do you develop friendships in preschool? if your attachment expectations are that people aren't going to be consistent or dependable and you can't really be sure what they're going to do, then when somebody approaches you in elementary school with the intention of trying to create a friendship, what do? Do you run away? Do you cry? Are you anxious? Do you grab onto them because you need friends? If you're a resistant kid, what do you do with somebody who's trying to become your friend? When you're a teenager and start dating, what do you do in the relationship? When you're in college and trying to find a partner and exploring relationships, what do you do? The literature suggests, on pretty flimsy evidence, that what you do is carry that infantile attachment style that you developed with mom into your later relationships. So what happens when you have a person who is anxiously attached, when her style or his style is anxious about attachments? You have somebody who clings. You have somebody who doesn't trust. So you have somebody who needs to be reassured constantly that they're important to you. If you look at the description of the behavior of the infant in the text, infants who are securely attached, anxiously attached, or resistantly attached, you'll find descriptions that might apply to people that you date or partners. And think about what happens when you put them together. How do they relate to each other? When one person is anxious, this is my favorite combination. One person is an anxious attacher, needs constant reassurance, and doesn't trust that you'll be there, so the cell phone is on all the time, right? I hope this doesn't hit too close to home. Turn your cell phone off for a few hours and see what your partner does when you don't respond. The anxious attacher is going to be glomming on. And then if you get a resistant attacher, resisting being glommed onto, you have a short-lived relationship. Remember Bowen's notion of togetherness and separateness. The togetherness person might reflect the anxious attachment style. The separateness person might reflect a resistant attachment style. If you put those two together, the relationship can be pretty fiery. Okay, so think about those possible combinations in your life, and we'll see you on Monday.